From PRI, Public Radio International.
Shades of unspeakable vicious things slid across the ground in big black shapes. Yellow sky turned a yellow-gray. I took Billy Lee's stockinged hand. "Let's dance," I said, shrill with the knowledge of what I was doing. "Like grown-ups," I said. He bowed deeply, cones flapping at his ears. I curtsied in my velvet, ostrich plume, my stays. Another coyote sprang up, into the yellow air, all four legs splayed. It yapped, landed in the grass, bounded off, and we chased it.
Maya Dillon reading an excerpt from Jean Dixon's Blue Waltz with Coyotes. You'll be hearing the complete story on today's edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. This Selected Shorts offers stories that deal with parents, kids, and siblings. For many American readers, the lottery is all they know of Shirley Jackson. But here's another surprising fiction, in which once again, on the surface, all seems normal and everyday, until the awful truth comes out so simply and with such riveting effect. Shirley Jackson's story, Charles, is read by the distinguished Broadway star, Lois Smith.
The day my son Laurie started kindergarten, he renounced corduroy overalls with bibs and began wearing blue jeans with a belt. I watched him go off the first morning with the older girl next door, seeing clearly that an era of my life was ended, my sweet-voiced nursery school tot replaced by a long-trousered, swaggering character who forgot to stop at the corner and wave goodbye to me. He came home the same way, the front door slamming open, his cap on the floor, and the voice suddenly become raucous, shouting, "Isn't anybody here?" At lunch, he spoke insolently to his father, spilled his baby sister's milk, and remarked that his teacher said we were not to take the name of the Lord in vain. "How was school today?" I asked, elaborately casual. "All right," he said. "Did you learn anything?" his father asked. Laurie regarded his father coldly. "I didn't learn nothing," he said. "Anything," I said. "Didn't learn anything." "The teacher spanked a boy, though," Laurie said, addressing his bread and butter. "For being fresh," he added, with his mouth full. "What did he do?" I asked. "Who was it?" Laurie thought. "It was Charles," he said. "He was fresh. The teacher spanked him and made him stand in a corner. He was awfully fresh." "What did he do?" I asked again, but Laurie slid off his chair, took a cookie, and left while his father was still saying, "See here, young man." The next day, Laurie remarked at lunch as soon as he sat down, "Well, Charles was bad again today." He grinned enormously and said, "Today Charles hit the teacher." "Good heavens," I said, mindful of the Lord's name. "I suppose he got spanked again." "He sure did," Laurie said. "Look up," he said to his father. "What?" his father said, looking up. "Look down," Laurie said. "Look at my thumb. Gee, you're dumb." He began to laugh insanely. "Why did Charles hit the teacher?" I asked quickly. "Because she tried to make him color with red crayons," Laurie said. "Charles wanted to color with green crayons, so he hit the teacher and she spanked him and said nobody play with Charles, but everybody did." The third day, it was Wednesday of the first week, Charles bounced a seesaw on the head of a little girl and made her bleed. And the teacher made him stay inside all during recess. Thursday, Charles had to stand in a corner during story time because he kept pounding his feet on the floor. Friday, Charles was deprived of blackboard privileges because he threw chalk. On Saturday, I remarked to my husband, Do you think kindergarten is too unsettling for Laurie? All this toughness and bad grammar, and this boy Charles sounds like such a bad influence? It'll be all right, my husband said reassuringly. Bound to be. People like Charles in the world, might as well meet them now as later. On Monday, Laurie came home late, full of news. Charles! He shouted as he came up the hill. I was waiting anxiously on the front steps. Charles! Laurie yelled all the way up the hill. Charles was bad again! Come right in, I said as soon as he came close enough. Lunch is waiting. You know what Charles did? He demanded, following me through the door. Charles yelled so in school they sent a boy in from first grade to tell the teacher she had to make Charles keep quiet. And so Charles had to stay after school, and so all the children stayed to watch him. What did he do? I asked. He just sat there, Laurie said, climbing into his chair at the table. Hi, Pop, you old dust mop. Charles had to stay after school today, I told my husband. Everyone stayed with him. What does this Charles look like? My husband asked Laurie. What's his other name? He's bigger than me, Laurie said, and he doesn't have any rubbers, and he doesn't ever wear a jacket. Monday night was the first parent-teachers meeting, and only the fact that the baby had a cold kept me from going. I wanted passionately to meet Charles's mother. On Tuesday, Laurie remarked suddenly, our teacher had a friend come to see her in school today. Charles's mother, my husband and I asked simultaneously. No, Laurie said scornfully. It was a man who came and made us do exercises. We had to touch our toes. Look, he climbed down from his chair and squatted down and touched his toes like this, he said. He got solemnly back into his chair and said, picking up his fork, Charles didn't even do exercises. That's fine, I said heartily. Didn't Charles want to do exercises? No, Laurie said. Charles was so fresh to the teacher's friend, he wasn't let do exercises. Fresh again, I said. He kicked the teacher's friend, Laurie said. The teacher's friend told Charles to touch his toes like I just did, and Charles kicked him. What are they going to do about Charles, do you suppose? Laurie's father asked him. Laurie shrugged elaborately. Throw him out of school, I guess, he said. Wednesday and Thursday were routine. Charles yelled during story hour and hit a boy in the stomach and made him cry. On Friday, Charles stayed after school again, and so did all the other children. With the third week of kindergarten, Charles was an institution in our family. The baby was being a Charles when she cried all afternoon. Laurie did a Charles when he filled his wagon full of mud and pulled it through the kitchen. Even my husband, when he caught his elbow in the telephone cord and pulled telephone ashtray and a bowl of flowers off the table, said after the first minute, looks like Charles. During the third and fourth weeks, it looked like a reformation in Charles. Laurie reported grimly at lunch on Thursday of the third week. Charles was so good today, the teacher gave him an apple. What? I said. And my husband added warily, you mean Charles? Charles, Laurie said. He gave the crayons around, and he picked up the books afterward, and the teacher said he was her helper. What happened? I asked incredulously. He was her helper, that's all, Laurie said and shrugged. Can this be true about Charles? I asked my husband that night. Can something like this happen? Wait and see, my husband said cynically. When you've got a Charles to deal with, this may mean he's only plotting. But he seemed to be wrong. For over a week, Charles was the teacher's helper. Each day he handed things out, he picked things up. No one had to stay after school. The PTA meeting's next week again, I told my husband one evening. I'm going to find Charles's mother there. Ask her what happened to Charles, my husband said. I'd like to know. I'd like to know myself, I said. On Friday of that week, things were back to normal. You know what Charles did today? Laurie demanded at the lunch table, in a voice slightly awed. He told a little girl to say a word, and she said it, and the teacher washed her mouth out with soap, and Charles laughed. What word? His father asked unwisely. And Laurie said, I'll have to whisper it to you. It's so bad. He got down off his chair and went around to his father. His father bent his head down, and Laurie whispered joyfully. His father's eyes widened. Did Charles tell the little girl to say that? He asked respectfully. She said it twice, Laurie said. Charles told her to say it twice. What happened to Charles? My husband asked. Nothing, Laurie said. He was passing out the crayons. Monday morning, Charles abandoned the little girl and said the evil word himself 3 or 4 times, getting his mouth washed out with soap each time. He also threw chalk. My husband came to the door with me that evening as I set out for the PTA meeting. Invite her over for a cup of tea after the meeting, he said. I want to get a look at her. If only she's there, I said prayerfully. She'll be there, my husband said. I don't see how they could hold a PTA meeting without Charles's mother. At the meeting, I sat restlessly scanning each comfortable matronly face, trying to determine which one hid the secret of Charles. None of them looked to me haggard enough. No one stood up in the meeting and apologized for the way her son had been acting. No one mentioned Charles. After the meeting, I identified and sought out Laurie's kindergarten teacher. She had a plate with a cup of tea and a piece of chocolate cake. I had a plate with a cup of tea and a piece of marshmallow cake. We maneuvered up to one another cautiously and smiled. I've been so anxious to meet you, I said. I'm Laurie's mother. We're all so interested in Laurie, she said. Well, he certainly likes kindergarten, I said. He talks about it all the time. We had a little trouble adjusting the first week or so, she said primly, but now he's a fine little helper with occasional lapses, of course. Laurie usually adjusts very quickly, I said. I suppose this time it's Charles's influence. Charles? Yes, I said, laughing. You must have your hands full in that kindergarten with Charles. Charles, she said. We don't have any Charles in the kindergarten.
Lois Smith read Shirley Jackson's story, Charles. The Israeli writer and filmmaker Edgar Keret, author of our next story, Pride and Joy, is another master of the unusual and the surprising. The reader of Pride and Joy is Robert Sean Leonard.
By the end of the first term, Ehud Guznik was already the tallest boy in his class, maybe even in the whole grade. And besides that, he had a new sports bike, a squat, hairy dog with the eyes of one of those old men who've been waiting in line at the public health clinic all morning, a girlfriend from his class who wouldn't kiss on the mouth but let him touch the boobs she didn't have, and a straight-A report card except for geography, and even that was because the teacher was a In short, Ehud had nothing to complain about, and his parents were bursting with pride. You couldn't bump into them without having to listen to a little anecdote about their amazing child, and people, like people, would nod at them in a mixture of boredom and genuine admiration and say, "Wonderful, Mr. Mrs. Guznik. That's really wonderful." But what really counts isn't what people say to your face, it's what they say behind your back. And behind their backs, the first thing people said about Max and Felicia Guznik was that they kept getting smaller. Over a single winter, they seemed to have lost at least 9 inches each. Mrs. Guznik, once considered imposing, now barely reached the breakfast cereal shelf in the grocery store, and Max, too, who once stood close to 5'10", had already moved the car seat all the way forward so that he could reach the gas pedal. Very unpleasant. and all the more obvious when they stood next to their giant of a son, only in fourth grade, but already a head taller than his mommy. Every Tuesday afternoon, Ehud went to the schoolyard with his father to play basketball. Ehud's father thought Ehud had great potential because he was both tall and smart. All through history, the Jews were always considered a smart people, but very short, he liked to explain. And even once in a blue moon, when a big schlub did get born, for some reason, he always turned out to be such a knucklehead that you couldn't even teach him a hook shot. But you could teach Ehud. And he got better from week to week. And lately, ever since his father started getting shorter, they were evenly matched. You, his father would tell him on the way home from the court, you will be a great player someday, the Moshe Dayan of basketball, except without the patch. The compliments made Ehud very proud, even though he'd never seen Moshe Dayan shoot hoops. But even more than he was proud, he was worried. Worried about the scary way his parents were getting shorter. Maybe all parents were like that, he sometimes tried to reassure himself out loud. And next year they'll teach us about it in science class. But deep in his heart, he knew something was wrong. Especially after Netta, who'd said yes when he asked her to go study with him 5 months before, swore to him on the Bible that her parents, from the time she was little, had stayed more or less the same height. The truth was that he wanted to talk to them about it, but he felt that there were things it was better not to talk about. Netta, for example, had a kind of light fuzz on her cheeks, like a beard. Ehud always pretended he didn't notice because he thought maybe she herself didn't know. And if he told her, she'd just feel bad. Maybe it was the same thing with his parents. Or maybe if they did know, they were still glad he didn't notice. Things went on like that until after Passover. Ehud's parents kept getting smaller, and he kept acting as if nothing was happening. And the truth is, no one would ever have figured it out if it hadn't been for Zeta. From the time he was a puppy, Ehud's dog was attracted to old people. That's why his favorite thing was walking in King David Park, where all the old people from the retirement home went to get some air. Zeta could sit next to them and listen to their long stories for hours. They were also the ones who gave him the name, Zeta, Grandpa, a name he liked a whole lot better than the original Jimmy he got at the pound. Of all the old men, Zeta's favorite was an old geezer in the billed cap who talked to him in Yiddish and fed him blood sausage. Ehud also liked that old man who made Ehud swear, the first time they met, never to get on an elevator with Zeta, because, according to him, dogs don't understand the concept of an elevator. And going into a kind of small room in one place and then seeing the doors open on another place altogether shakes their confidence in their spatial perception and, in general, makes them feel extremely inferior. He didn't offer Ehud any blood sausage, but he did treat him to jelly beans and chocolate coins wrapped in gold. That old man must have died or moved to a different home because they didn't see him in the park anymore. Sometimes Zeta still barked and ran after a different old man who looked enough like him and then whimpered a little when he found out he was wrong, but that was all. One day, after Passover, Ehud came home from school in a bad mood, and when he finished walking Zeta, he didn't feel like going up the stairs. So they took the elevator. He felt a little guilty as he pressed the 4 button, but said to himself that the old man was probably dead anyway, which definitely meant he didn't have to keep his promise. And when the elevator door opened, Zeta peered out, walked into the hall, back into the elevator, contemplated for a second, and fainted dead away. Ehud and his frightened parents went straight to the vet, who reassured them right away about the dog, but the vet was much more than your ordinary vet. He was a family doctor and gynecologist from South America. who, at some point in his life, for personal reasons, had decided to treat animals. And that doctor needed only one look to realize that the Guzniks were suffering from a rare family disease, a disease that resulted in Ehud's growing taller and taller, but at his parents' expense. It's simple math, the vet explained. Every inch added to the child is an inch subtracted from the parents. And this disease, Ehud probed, when does it end? End? The vet tried to camouflage his sorrow behind his thick Argentinian accent. Only when the parents disappear. All the way home, Ehud cried, and his parents tried to comfort him. Strangely enough, their terrible fate didn't bother them at all. In fact, they even seemed to enjoy it a little. Lots of parents are dying to sacrifice everything for their children, his mother explained to him when he was already in bed. But not all of them get the chance. Do you know how awful it is to be like Aunt Bella, who sees her son growing up to be short, stupid, and untalented just like his father, and she can't do a thing about it? Okay, it's true that in the end we'll disappear, but so what? In the end, everyone dies, and your father and me, we won't even die. We'll just disappear. The next day, Ehud went to school without really feeling like it and got thrown out of Bible class again. He was sitting on the steps near the gym feeling sorry for himself when he suddenly realized something. If he grew an inch at his parents' expense, all he had to do to save them was to stop growing. Ehud hurried to the nurse's office and slyly asked for all the information she had on the subject. And from all the brochures she shoved at him, Ehud learned that if he wanted to put up a real fight against growing, what he had to do was smoke a lot, eat little and not regularly, and sleep even less, preferably with lots of interruptions. He gave his 10 o'clock recess sandwich to Shiri, a nice chubby girl from the other fourth grade class. He ate as little as he could at meals, and to keep people from suspecting, he always passed the meat and dessert to his faithful dog, who waited under the table with sad eyes. The sleeping thing worked out by itself, because since that meeting with the vet, he couldn't sleep for 10 minutes without waking up from scary, guilt-ridden nightmares, which left the business with the cigarettes. He smoked 2 packs a day of cheap, unfiltered cigarettes. 2 whole packs, not one cigarette less. His eyes got red, his mouth filled with a bitter taste, and he also started to cough, an old man's cough. But not for a minute did he think of stopping. A year and something later, on the day report cards were formally handed out, Matt Thlotnitsky and Raz Samara were already taller than he was. Raz also became Netta's new boyfriend after she dumped Ehud because of the bad breath he'd developed. In fact, that year, Ehud's popularity declined. To tell the truth, the kids stopped talking to him completely because they said his chronic cough got on their nerves, and besides, his marks were going down and he wasn't good at sports anymore. The only one who still spoke to him was Shiri, who had started out liking him because of the sandwiches, but later took to him because of his personality and other things, and they spent hours together talking about all kinds of stuff he'd never talked about with Netta. Ehud's parents stopped shrinking at 8 inches. And after the doctor confirmed it, Ehud even tried to stop smoking but couldn't. He went to an acupuncturist and a hypnotist, and they both said that the main reason he couldn't stop was pampering and character. But Shiri, who actually liked the smell of cigarettes, consoled him by saying that it really didn't matter. On Saturdays, Ehud would put his parents in his shirt pocket and take them for a bike ride. He pedaled slowly enough for the stout Zeta to keep up with him. And when his parents fought inside his pocket or just got tired of each other, he would move one of them to another pocket. Once Shiri even went with them, and they rode to the park and had a real picnic. And on the way back, when they stopped to look at the sunset, Ehud's father whispered loudly to him from his pocket, "Kiss her. Kiss her." Which was a little embarrassing. Ehud quickly changed the subject and talked to her about the sun and how hot and big it was, all kinds of things like that, until it was dark. And his parents fell asleep, deep in his pocket. When he'd exhausted all his stories about the sun and they'd almost reached Shiri's house, he told her about the moon and the stars, too, and their effect on each other. And when those stories were finished, too, he coughed and shut up. And Shiri said to him, "Kiss me." And he kissed her. "Way to go, son," he could hear his father whisper from the depths of his pocket. And he felt his emotional mother jab him with her elbow and softly weep with joy.
Robert Sean Leonard read Pride and Joy by Edgar Carret. After a quick break, we'll be back with two more stories about family matters. You're listening to selected shorts recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts, recorded live at Symphony Space in New York City. Our Family Matters program turns now to a tale of brothers and sisters, Jane Dixon's Blue Waltz with Coyotes. The reader is Maya Dillon.
Before my brother was born, Dad promised that if I didn't like the baby, we could throw him to the coyotes. I didn't like him. Billy Lee was always wet. He smelled bad, and he got more than his share of attention. By the time he was 4, he hadn't improved. He still didn't talk. "He don't have to talk," Mom said. "He rolls those big brown eyes of his and wraps you around his finger." Not me, he didn't. I held out for coyotes. My dad had gone back on his word to the point that when we were ready to move away from the Two Medicine, where we had plenty of coyotes, coyotes that left bloody and mutilated sheep carcasses littered across the plains, and move to a ranch near Columbia Falls, loading all our household belongings into an old 36 Dodge truck with a cattle rack to contain everything, Billy Lee went along. And I didn't like him any better on the west side than I had on the eastern slope of the mountains. We still had plenty of coyotes. "Nope," Dad said, hunkering down and stroking his chin the way he did when he had bad news to deliver. "You're growing up. 8 years old is too old to keep fretting about a little brother. Try to get along. Find something else to occupy your mind." Most of that summer, I didn't have time to think about coyotes. I had to help Mom and neighbor women cook for farm crews. I pumped hundreds of buckets of water to carry to the house, hauled in that many armloads of firewood for the Black Iron Monarch. I caught friars, chopped their heads off, scalded them, plucked them, drew them. The women fried them in sizzling fat in black iron skillets. Heat swamped us. Meat roasting, baking, stewing, vegetables at the boil, biscuits baking or white bread, cornbread, and desserts. Ice cream to crank in the maker, berries to pick for pies, cakes, gingerbread, cinnamon rolls, strudel rising in the swelter. Tempers flared. Big Anna Anderson, with her baby fine hair, splattered glasses, and ragged apron, always complaining. Bossy Chrissy Olmsted, always scolding. "What you going to do it that way for? I told you and told you, for gosh sakes." She grabbed the peeler out of my hand, make potato peels fly like a January blizzard through the hot, unbearable steam of the kitchen. If we opened the door, flies swarmed in. Clouds of flies attacked us, biting our necks, arms, faces. They clamped themselves to our sticky skin like carpet. While I worked in the kitchen, Billy Lee played in the shade with his dump trucks, or took his nap, or rode into town with Dad to pick up parts for the mower. At the end of haying, Anna Anderson gave him a nickel for being so good. She gave my mother and the other women each a big bottle of Blue Waltz perfume from Woolworth's, a heady concoction of floral scents blended with musk, possibly, or civet. It came in a thick bottle of deepest blue, a gold cap, glass wand, and stopper. Mom said she didn't particularly care for it, that I was welcome to hers. But Anna's leaving me out the way she did stirred up hurt feelings. I thought long and deep about coyotes. Up in the piney bluffs behind the woods where the aluminum plant would go in one day, coyotes yapped and howled. We had to put the chickens in at night, drive the lambs back into the shed. We found fresh tracks around the farm, but the coyotes seemed content to thrive on what they hunted in the red rock ledges, for they never bothered our stock. The day I got left out of the big perfume giveaway, I decided I'd go and bother them, Billy Lee included. While Mom and Dad slept on a blanket under the tree, I told Billy Lee we could play a new game, party. First, we would have to dress up. I doused us both with Blue Waltz, then led him up the ladder to a storage place across from the haymow in the barn. In the musty dark among spiders, mice, secret packets of dynamite, binder twine, tire chains rusting in a corner, rangeland romance with pictures of grown-ups hugging and kissing, we hauled Mom's old rag bag from under a horse collar, opened it up. Long-legged underwear, an oriental parasol, ostrich plume hat, a Queen Victoria bustled gown, strings of beads, corsets with stays, a whirl-away cape of yellow silk, lace net petticoats that rustled when we held them up to study them. Billy Lee stuck an enormous brassiere on top of his head. It flopped over his ears like two huge cones. He tied it under his chin. We laughed. He skinnied out of his overalls, shirt, shoes, socks. Out of the wealth we had to choose from, he chose a gray shantung dress that looked like Anna Anderson, a multi-layered lace net petticoat over the dress, laddered silk stockings up his arms like long gloves, a string of glass beads that swung to his middle. I pulled the Queen Victoria velvet over my jeans, pulled a floppy bone corset over the dress, donned the ostrich plume hat, and tied the yellow silk cape around my neck for final effect. We chose high-heeled pumps, mine with jeweled buckles, his with bows. Reeking of mothballs and the floral perfume, we climbed down the ladder, rung by rung. "Careful," I warned him sweetly, "don't you fall." And we went through the barn, out the back where the cows came in, out into the long summer twilight. Sky and grass had turned the same shade of yellow as the cape on my shoulders. Yellow coulees rose around us, leading us away from the house, out toward the gully, the alkali plain, the long, dark shadow of the mountain. Coyotes. We lifted our skirts over cow pies, dragged them through harsh yellow grass into the cool yellow wind. I yapped, three quick barks, a long howl. A coyote answered. Billy Lee yapped. We both yapped. The breeze grew stronger, cooler, as we moved up the coulee. It caught our veils and billowed our skirts, rattled corset stays and beads, tugged at the yellow cape as we stumbled along in our awkward shoes. Billy Lee tripped and fell. The brassiere flopped one cone over his face. I laughed loud. He got up, stickers in his foot, looked about to cry, laughed instead. We both shrieked with false laughter, and over the top of a coulee, looking down at us, we saw the silhouette of a coyote. He had drawn his lips back to fangs. He peered down at us through yellow, slit eyes, and his sleek body looked rigid as a black paper cutout. My skin, lungs, guts turned to ice. "Come on," I said to Billy Lee, taking his stocking-clad arm. "He won't hurt us." The coyote disappeared, and the earth cooled in the yellow wind. Billy Lee and I proceeded up the coulee, over the stony ridge, down into a boulder-strewn gully and an ancient stream bed. Shadows stirred in the grass. A pheasant flew up, beating the air, squawking. Billy Lee stopped, turned to me. I said, "It's okay, everything's fine." And a coyote sprang out from behind a rock. It flew straight up into the air, jaws open, teeth flashing. It came down in the tussocks of grass, tail between its legs, yipping, yapping. Two more appeared on the ridgeline. The three dashed away. We were close, I thought, to what we had come for. Down in the gully, no air stirred. Shades of unspeakable vicious things slid across the ground in big black shapes. Yellow sky turned a yellow-gray. I took Billy Lee's stockinged hand. "Let's dance," I said, shrill with the knowledge of what I was doing. "Like grown-ups," I said. He bowed deeply, cones flapping at his ears. I curtsied in my velvet, ostrich plume, my stays. Another coyote sprang up, up into the yellow air, all four legs splayed. It yapped, landed in the grass, bounded off, and we chased it. Three others came down from the ridge at the far end of the gully. They raced along in the twilight, a single swath of gray silk, their feet skimming the ground, nose to tail, attached like a single fur neck piece women wore in those days to the movies. Silent. Billy Lee and I ducked behind a rock. As the line of coyotes rushed past us, we jumped out at them, yipping and barking. They whirled so fast their tails curved around them, and they sprang straight up, barking like our imitation of them. They laughed, chuckled, howled. We chased after them, our skirts held high, my yellow silk flaring out in the falling light, Billy Lee's petticoats lofting about him like sails. He tripped and fell. One of the coyotes ran back to him. "No!" I shouted as if to a dog. "No! Go away!" The coyote pushed the fallen Billy Lee with her nose. Billy Lee got up. The coyote waited, patient, ears twitching forward and back like a mother dog with her pup. She lay down in the grass in front of him, head flat to the ground, ears down, tail swaying gently in the grass. "She likes you," I said. "She does. She really does like you." Billy Lee put his feet back into the high-heeled pumps with bows, and he did a pirouette in his foolish dress. The coyote danced away, looked back over her shoulder, woofed, trotted ahead, stopped, and looked back. She wanted us to go with her. And we went. Once out of the gully, we danced on an alkali plain in moonlight. The white poison ground baked hard as a dance floor. Reeking with perfume, we bowed to the coyotes, curtsied. We took hands and whirled around, and an allemande left a do-si-so in our two big shoes, our silks and our plumes. We honored our corners, the watching coyotes, and we danced in the darkening winds as the wild creatures danced with us. Coyotes darting in and out, weaving a mystery of wilderness and easing the hatreds, the violence, all those hard, forbidden thoughts that plague us, eased them as wild things always ease heartache.
Maya Dillon read Blue Waltz with Coyotes by Jane Dixon. Our final story in this program dealing with tales of family matters is Rick Moody's haunting narrative that goes by the simple four-letter title of Boys. In a style reminiscent of Virginia Woolf's lyrical The Years, this almost poem chronicles the lives of two brothers from childhood to adulthood. Listen for the musical repetition that signals time passing. Rick Moody's story, Boys, is read by B.D. Wong.
Boys enter the house. Boys enter the house. Boys, and with them, the ideas of boys. Ideas leaden, reductive, inflexible, enter the house. Boys, two of them. Wound into hospital packaging, boys with infant pattern baldness, slung in the arms of parents, boys dreaming of breasts, enter the house. Twin boys, kettles on the boil, boys in hideous vinyl knapsacks that young couples from Edison, New Jersey wear on their shirt fronts, knapsacks coated with baby saliva and staphylococcus and milk vomit, enter the house. Two boys, one striking the other with a rubberized hot dog, enter the house. Two boys, one of them striking the other with a willow switch about the head and shoulders, the other crying, enter the house. Boys enter the house speaking nonsense. Boys enter the house calling for mother. On a Sunday in May, a day one might nearly describe as perfect, an ice cream truck comes slowly down the lane. Chimes inducing salivation, and children run after it, not long after which boys dig a hole in the backyard and bury their younger sister's dolls 2 feet down so that she will never find these dolls, and these dolls will rot in hell, after which boys enter the house. Boys, trailing after their father like his is the second coming of Christ Almighty, enter the house, repair the basement to watch baseball. Boys enter the house, sight of devastation, and repair immediately to the kitchen, where they mix lighter fluid, vanilla pudding, drain-opening lye, balsamic vinegar, blue food coloring, calamine lotion, cottage cheese, ants, a plastic lizard one of them received in a Christmas stocking, tacks, leftover mashed potatoes, Spam, frozen lima beans, and chocolate syrup in a medium-sized saucepan and heat over a low flame until thick. Afterward, transferring the contents of this saucepan into a Pyrex lasagna dish, baking the Pyrex lasagna dish in the oven for 19 minutes before attempting to persuade their sister that she should eat the mixture. Later, they smash 3 family heirlooms, the last, a glass egg, intentionally, in a 2.5-hour stretch, whereupon they are sent to their bedroom until freed, in each case 13 minutes after. Boys enter the house, starchy and pressed shirts and flannel pants that itch so bad, fresh from Sunday school instruction. Blonde and brown locks, respectively, plastered down, but even so with a number of cowlicks protruding at odd angles. Disconsolate and humbled. Uncertain if boyish things, such as shooting at the neighbor's dog with a pump-action BB gun, and gagging the fat boy up the street with a bandana, and showing their shriveled boy penises to their younger sister, are exempted from the commandment to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind and thy neighbor as thyself. Boys enter the house in baseball gear. Only one of the boys can hit. In their spikes, in mismatched tube socks that smell like Stilton cheese. Boys enter the house in soccer gear. Boys enter the house carrying skates. Boys enter the house with lacrosse sticks, and soon after, tossing a lacrosse ball lightly in the living room, they destroy a lamp. One boy enters the house sporting basketball clothes, the other wearing jeans and a sweatshirt. One boy enters the house bleeding profusely and is taken out to get stitches. The other watches. Boys enter the house at the end of term, carrying report cards. Sneak around the house like spies of foreign nationality, looking for a place to hide the report cards for the time being. Under a toaster? In a medicine cabinet? One boy with a black eye enters the house. One boy without. Boys with acne enter the house and squeeze and prod large skin blemishes in front of their sister. Boys with acne treatment products hidden about their persons enter the house. Boys standing just up the street sneak cigarettes behind a willow in the Ellis's yard, wave smoke away from their natural fibers, hack terribly, experience nausea, then enter the house. Boys call each other retard, homo, geek, and later, necklace thug, theater fag, and enter the house, exchanging further epithets. Boys enter the house with nose hair clippers, chase sister around house, threatening to depilate her eyebrows. She cries. Boys attempt to induce girls, to whom they would not have spoken only 6 or 8 months prior, to enter the house with them. Boys enter the house with girls efflorescent and homely, and attempt to induce girls to sneak into their bedroom, as they still share a single bedroom. Girls refuse. Boys enter the house, go to separate bedrooms. Boys, with their father, an arm around each of them, enter the house, but of the monologue preceding and succeeding this entrance, not a syllable is preserved. Boys enter the house, having masturbated in train station bathrooms, in forests, in beach houses, in football bleachers at night under the stars, in cars under a blanket, in the shower, backstage, on a plane. The boys masturbate constantly. Identically, 3 times a day in some cases. Desire like a madness upon them at the mere sound of certain words, words that sound like other words. Interrogative, reminding them of intercourse. Beast, reminding them of breast. Sects, reminding them of sex, and so forth. The boys are not very smart yet, and as they enter the house, they feel, as always, immense shame at the scale of this self-abusive cogitation, seeing a classmate, seeing a billboard, seeing a fire hydrant, seeing things that should not induce thoughts of masturbation, their sister, for example, and then thinking of masturbation anyway. Boys enter the house, go to their rooms, remove sexually explicit magazines from hidden stashes, put on loud music, feel despair. Boys enter the house worried. They argue. The boys are ugly. They are failures. They will never be loved. They enter the house. Boys enter the house and kiss their mother, who feels differently now they have outgrown her. Boys enter the house, kiss their mother. She explains the seriousness of their sister's difficulty, her diagnosis. Boys enter the house, having attempted to locate the spot in their yard where the dolls were buried 8 or 9 years prior, without success. They go to their sister's room, sit by her bed. Boys enter the house and tell their completely bald sister jokes about baldness. Boys hold either hand of their sister, laying aside differences, having trudged grimly into the house. Boys skip school, enter house, hold vigil. Boys enter the house after their parents have both gone off to work, sit with their sister and with their sister's nurse. Boys enter the house carrying cases of beer. Boys enter the house very worried now. Didn't know more worry was possible. Boys enter the house carrying controlled substances, neither having told the other that he is carrying a controlled substance, though an intoxicated posture seems appropriate under the circumstances. Boys enter the house weeping and hear weeping around them. Boys enter the house embarrassed, silent, anguished, keening, afflicted, angry, woeful, grief-stricken. Boys enter the house on vacation. Each clasps the hand of the other with genuine warmth. The one wearing dark colors and having shaved a portion of his head, the other having grown his hair out longish and wearing, uncharacteristically, a tie-dyed shirt. Boys enter the house on vacation and argue bitterly about politics. Other subjects are no longer discussed. One boy supporting the Maoist insurgency in a certain Southeast Asian country. One believing that to change the system, you need to work inside it. One boy threatens to beat the living shit out of the other. Refuses creme brulee, though it is created by his mother in order to keep the peace. One boy writes home and thereby enters the house only through a mail slot. He argues that the other boy is crypto-fascist, believing that the market can seek its own level on questions of ethics and morals. Boys enter the house on vacation and announce future professions. Boys enter the house on vacation and change their minds about professions. Boys enter the house on vacation and one boy brings home a sweetheart but throws a tantrum when it is suggested that the sweetheart will have to retire on the folding bed in the basement. The other boy, having no sweetheart, is distant and withdrawn, preferring to talk late into the night about family members gone from this world. Boys enter the house several weeks apart. Boys enter the house on days of heavy rain. Boys enter the house in different calendar years, and upon entering, the boys seem to do nothing but compose manifestos for the benefit of parents. They follow their mother around the place, having fashioned these manifestos in celebration of brand new independence. Mom, I like to lie in bed late into the morning watching game shows. Or, I'm never going to date anyone but artists from now on. Mad girls. Dreamers. Practicers of black magic. Or, a man should eat bologna. Sliced meats are important. Or, an American should bowl at least once a year. But these manifestos only apply for brief spells, after which they are reversed or discarded. Boys don't enter the house at all, except as ghostly afterimages of younger selves, fleeting images of sneakers dashing up a staircase, soggy towels on the floor of the bathroom, blue jeans coiled like asps in the basin of the washing machine. Boys as an absence of boys. Blissful at first. You put a thing down on a spot, put this book down, come back later, it's still there. You buy a box of cookies, eat three. Later, three are missing. Nevertheless, when boys next enter the house, which they ultimately must do, it's a relief. Even if it's only in preparation for weddings of acquaintances in boyhood. One boy has a beard, neatly trimmed. The other has rakish sideburns. One boy wears a hat. The other boy thinks hats are ridiculous. One boy wears khakis pleated at the waist. The other wears denim. But each changes into his suit. One suit fits well. One is a little tight. As though suits are the liminary marker of adulthood. Boys enter the house after the wedding, and they are slapping each other on the back and yelling at anyone who will listen, "It's a party!" One boy enters the house, carried by friends, having been arrested after the wedding for driving while intoxicated, complexion ashen. The other boy tries to keep his mouth shut. The car is on its side in a ditch. The car has the top half of a tree broken over its bonnet. The car has struck another car, which has in turn struck a third. Everyone will have seen. One boy misses his brother horribly, misses the past, misses a time worth being nostalgic over. A time that never existed, back when they set their sister's playhouse on fire. The other boy avoids all mention of that time. Each of them is once the boy who enters the house alone, missing the other. Each is devoted and each callous, and each plays his part on the telephone over the course of months. Boys enter the house with fishing gear, according to prearranged date and time, arguing about whether to use lures or live bait in order to meet their father for the fishing adventure, after which boys enter the house again, almost immediately, with live bait, having settled the question. Boys boast of having caught fish in the past, though no fish has ever been caught. Remember when the blues were biting? Boys enter the house carrying their father, slumped. Happens so fast. Boys rush into the house leading EMTs to the couch in the living room where the body lies. Boys enter the house. Boys enter the house. Boys enter the house. Boys hold open the threshold, awesome threshold that has welcomed them when they haven't been able to welcome themselves. That threshold which welcomed them when they had to be taken in. Here is its tarnished knocker. Here is its euphonious bell. Here's where the boys had to sand the door down because it never would hang right in the frame. Here are the scuff marks from when boys were on the wrong side of the door, demanding. Here's where there were once milk bottles for the milkman. Here's where the newspaper always landed. Here's the mail slot. Here's the light on the front step, illuminated. Here's where the boys are standing as that beloved man is carried out. Boys, no longer boys. Exit.
B.D. Wong read Rick Moody's story, Boys. If you enjoyed this program's stories about family matters, you might be interested in knowing all about our CD collection of that name. For full details, go to selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our theme music is Roger Calloway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2008 by Salman Rushdie, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, Budget Travel, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, and the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.